You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest on today's podcast is Rosalind Chow, who is an Associate Professor of Organizational Behavior and Theory at Carnegie Mellon University, where she directs executive education programs that advance the careers of Black and Latino professionals and advises corporations on their sponsorship programs. She has a fantastic new book. It's called The Doors You Can Open, A New Way to Network, Build Trust, and Use Your Influence to Create a More Inclusive Workplace. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Rosalind Chow, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
In the introduction of your new book, you introduce us to Kim Ang. Can you tell us who she is and why she's the origin story and kind of a thread that runs through the book?
Sure. So Kim Ang, for those of you who are not baseball fans, of which I would consider myself one, as in not after that, as in not a baseball fan.
Yeah.
So Kim Ang was the first and only, to this date, woman general manager for a major league baseball team. That was for the Miami Marlins, and what is notable about her is, of course, the fact that she was the first woman GM. But the reason I use her to open the book is because she was quite possibly the most qualified person to take on that role, like ever. So when she was finally chosen to be the GM there, people started coming out and saying, like, wait, why has it taken her so long to get this role? And turns out she got that role in large part because of a strong supporter named Derek Jeter, who, if you don't have to be a baseball fan to know who Derek Jeter is.
He's very important.
A Hall of Famer, Derek Jeter was actually co-owner and CEO of the Miami Marlins at the time. When the GM role came up, he basically was like, Kim is the one that I want. And so he went out and asked her if she wanted the position. And the thing that I think is really important about this situation is, like, Kim Ang is an example of a person who was already amazing. She was highly qualified. She had been working in baseball for, I don't know, like 20 some odd years by then, had already taken on many of the roles that would have qualified her for a GM position, and had even interviewed for many of other teams' GM positions, but nobody wanted to take the risk, I guess. And it wasn't until she had a sponsor in Derek Jeter that she was finally able to get this position. Again, the key thing I feel like is really important for listeners is that she had a sponsor and not a mentor, right? There was nothing wrong with Kim Ang. She just needed someone to step up and say, this person is not as risky as you think they are. They're amazing. And so the book is about how more of us can do that for other people.
So when I like a book, I talk about a lot, which everyone, my colleagues, will make fun of me. The call before this, I was telling my colleagues about this book. And I said, it's about sponsorship, which is different from mentorship. And they say, how is it different? That was the first question I got right away. So yep. let's jump into that because they are.
Yeah. So the way that I differentiate mentorship from sponsorship is I ask this question of who is acted upon. So who's being asked to change? And so when you think about mentorship, the person who's being asked to change is actually the mentee. So oftentimes when we think about mentors, it's a senior person who's trying to help coach, guide a more junior person. You give them feedback on areas of potential growth. You coach them through politically perhaps tricky situations, or you just give them kind of like general career advice. But all of that is meant to try and get the mentee themselves to change something about them. So sponsorship acts on, is asking a completely different person to change, not the person who's being sponsored, but the audience to whom the sponsor is sponsoring the person to, right? So it's this third party who's being asked to be changed, that they actually see the protege or behave differently toward the protege than they had before. And so this could be introducing someone, creating a relationship where no relationship existed previously, augmenting positive impressions, but also protecting them from negative impressions that other people might have of them. But in all cases, sponsorship is about changing this external party and not changing the protege themselves.
And you have a really killer line about this. You say mentors talk to you, sponsors talk about you. And what I love about that, and it ties in to a lot of my theories about why Second City and improv and comedy are so effective in these spaces, is because we have to inherently involve the audience. If people aren't laughing, it is not funny. So we have a completely different relationship with the audience than other kinds of art forms that don't need to take that in consideration, because here you are talking about there's at least three different people or entities involved in these conversations. And to understand intentionally those differences, we have so much more agency, because when we don't, we could be making crucial errors that we're not even aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. It complicates things significantly, mm-hmm. right? Because now you're not just managing your own relationship with the person you're trying to help. You're also trying to manage your personal relationship with the person you're acting on. You're trying to manage their relationship. So it's already increasing the complexity significantly. But with complexity, I guess, as you're pointing out, Kelly, comes like opportunities. It means you have what researchers like to say, call like so many more degrees of freedom to work with.
And trust becomes this incredible ingredient with this. And so I've seen some research on this before. You talk about gossip as really about trust. And, mm-hmm. and I think that might surprise people, because they see gossip as inherently negative, but I think it ties into ethic and moral frameworks, right?
Oh, absolutely. So the we all have a negative impression of gossip because we're quite frankly afraid to be the target of gossip.
Yes, that's right.
And it's typically because when we think of gossip, we're thinking about negative gossip. And the people who are negatively gossiped about are typically the people who have violated some norm that is like deeply held by the group. And so obviously we don't want to be targets of gossip for that reason. And I think that's why gossip has this negative connotation. But the flip side is that we all benefit from gossip as well, because what gossip allows us to do is not have to learn from personal experience who's not to be trusted.
That's right.
Or who's not going to, follow through on what they claim they're going to do. Gossip is really about people who either violate social norms or quite frankly, is about trust. Because, well, most social norms is like, if you say you're going to do something, you're going to, then you actually follow through and do it. And so it's actually, it's very helpful for groups to have that gossip. And what I'm saying in the book is that instead of using gossip as a way to warn people away from bad actors, we can also think of sponsorship as good gossip in that we essentially alert people to the presence of good actors. And hopefully that seeds relationships that make the world better for everyone.
All right. So we've talked about this difference between mentors and sponsors. You have another sort of duo that you talk about, which is the difference between power and status. My wife is obsessed with status, especially she teaches comedy. And as you could probably, you look at status inside comedy, like comedy duos, right? That is all a status play. That's where the comedy comes from. And Allison Forgale has been on the podcast, and we've talked about Likeable Badass and her work, which I think is terrific as well. Mm-hmm. So I know from my experience that I've realized over time that status is more effective for me than power. I'm just going to let you riff on that. Talk a bit about these two things.
Sure. So a lot of people, so if you haven't read Allison's book, it's an amazing book. Mm-hmm. So the difference between power and status is that for the most part, people kind of see them as interchangeable, but they're not. Power refers to control over resources. So if I control some resource that you want, to the extent that you can't get that resource from anywhere else, I have a lot of power over you. And so I can get you to do things that I want because you kind of feel like you have to do what I tell you to do, because otherwise bad things are going to happen to you. Status operates differently. Status is like when people do things for you because they want to, because they like you and they trust you. And so if you tell them to do something, they're like, well, Kelly told me to do this and I trust Kelly. And so I'm going to go out and, you know, I'll do what he tells me to do. So status is comes from respect and admiration that other people have for us. So it's inherently relational in the sense that status is given to us by others.
Yeah.
And so the way to gain, so you can gain power by focusing on collecting like resources, mm-hmm. but you can gain status by essentially demonstrating to other people how you're someone they should respect and admire. And this goes back to our earlier point about like trust and what is that built on and gossip, right? It's we give status to people we trust to want good things for us and good things for the collective. And so what it tends to compel people to do is actually engage in much more what we would say like collective or communally oriented behavior. So if you want to gain status, be a nice person. Mm-hmm. And if you want to gain power, well, being a nice person isn't necessarily part of that calculus.
Sure isn't. We have examples every day. Okay. One of the other things I find interesting about status. So I know a lot of famous people, and I always have. My dad interviewed famous people. He had a radio and TV show here for 3 decades, and then I worked at Second City. And one of the things I've noticed about the vast majority of my famous friends who are successful, it's not all, but it's the majority, is that they often will reduce their own status in situations. Mm-hmm. So they recognize they have it. And they recognize that that if they want someone else to either take the spotlight or, you know, they don't want to be ostentatious or whatever, they will lower their status. Tina Fey, masterful of this. Just someone who, you know, she when she's on a talk show, she's got the status pull, and that's what she's doing her stuff. But she's a business person as well. And I've been in so many situations where I've seen her lower her status as a way to push someone else up. Mm-hmm. And if you think about all these alumni, they all work on each other's shows, you know, so 30 Rock or Parks and Rec, or even going back to Cheers, it's like oh, they all sponsored each other. They were like, oh, yeah. You came from my
that's right.
Essentially my comedy college. Uh-huh. Right? Is that interesting?
I mean, it's really about being incredibly generous with your network, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that I love about improv too is that I think it's actually a perfect instantiation of sponsorship in action. And what I mean by that is, just as you were pointing out, it's like that so many of the successful people you know are the ones who give other people status, right? By playing down their status. In a way, that's kind of what you're doing with sponsorship as well, is mm-hmm. you are giving other people status by saying really wonderful things about them. And you're not making yourself the center of attention, right? So you're increasing somebody else's, other people's admiration and respect for that person that you're sponsoring. And when I think about improv, you know, you're supposed to, like, I guess one of the rules is you're supposed to always, like, be trying to make your partner look good.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And so, and in a way, you're kind of like, that is just, you're just trying to raise their status. But when you're both trying to raise each other's status together, the combination of all that activity is a performance that's like greater than the sum of its parts, right? Like, that's kind of, in a way, like the point. And so that's another thing that I really would love your listeners to take away from this, which is like, sponsorship, yes, you are giving status to somebody else, but in giving status to somebody else, you gain status yourself.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the collective is better for it. So it's not actually, the benefits don't just accrue to the individuals who are involved. It's actually a benefit to the collective as a whole. And you can think of that as like the enjoyment that the audience gets from two really, really, or more really great improvers working together, right? That experience, that benefit really comes from this intangible, like, constant building of giving each other giving.
Do you think that this is is the improv thing at all relatable to when you talk about group-oriented power?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, talk because I thought that was interesting. The line I picked out from the book was, quote, research shows that group-oriented power holders are more attentive to others rather than less. That would seem like the
yes,
same thing.
That totally tracks. Yes. Right? Yeah. Because so much of improv is just like, is really paying attention to your partner. Mm-hmm.
And it's a group. It's sometimes right. It's one other, sometimes it's seven others.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's another thing that differentiates status from power, is that what you typically find is that people who are in the mindset or position of power are very self-focused. So they're very focused on their own goals, achieving their own ends, and they see other people typically as a means to an end. Whereas people who are high in status, because it's this thing that's given by others, they, for them to maintain their status, they have to be quite cognizant of what is going on with other people in order to be able to help others in a way that allows them to maintain their high status, if that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. So it's we give status to people who basically show themselves to be more concerned about other people than concerned about themselves. And so that essentially means that if we care about having status, we just need to pay more attention to other people.
This is where you name drop that you took improv classes.
Yes, that's right. I steal city improv.
Yeah, you did level one. So you
did level one.
You got like 7 weeks of improv in you. That's more than most of my guests. All right. Another interesting thing in this section is you say, quote, when we sponsor, it's best if our audience doesn't notice it, because persuasion and influence attempts are most effective when they aren't seen as such. Having status obscures the likelihood that people see our sponsorship as its true form, a form of persuasion and influence. That's some jiu-jitsu.
Yes, it is. It's, I mean, you think about any kind of marketing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The best marketing is the stuff that you don't notice. Like, I think about, like, Coca-Cola and their polar bears. Nobody, what does Coca-Cola have anything to do with polar bears? Absolutely nothing, right? But you do remember the polar bears, and you remember that warm, fuzzy feeling that you have thinking about the cute polar bears, and you think of Coke, and now you have that association in your mind.
And I, my friend Kathy Twelves at Coke sent us a giant Coca-Cola polar bear that lives in my front screened-in porch.
Amazing.
So when kids are going down, and we also have a giraffe that named Toto. So when kids are going down the street, they're always like pointed out. So we just kept them there for like 7 years. all right. So chapter three is a cage match, and I'm calling it that. I know it's not. It's a cage match between Elon Musk and George Clooney. So,
right. Like, I'm somewhat regretting the choice of characters right now, but okay.
Well, one of them you are. But I read my distaste of Elon Musk did not stop me from being interested and thinking it's completely valid when you talk about these two individuals and how they are both similar and different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the hypothetical cage match is this question of who has more social capital, Elon Musk or George Clooney? And of course, I take the academics answer, which is that they both have social capital. It's just different types. Yeah. And you know, so George Clooney has what I call small town social capital, and so this is the social capital that comes from having really strong close bonds with like a smaller set of individuals who are all closely connected with each other. So George Clooney inhabits what I would think of as being a more dense network, mm-hmm. if we're using network language, than Elon Musk, who has what we would call a very loose, like disconnected network, mm-hmm. where a lot of his contacts may not know each other, whereas all of George Clooney's friends are friends with each other.
Including Second City alum Richard Kind.
He is
Richard is one of the Clooney cronies.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, okay.
So I've heard a bunch of these stories about him.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so here's after the show, I'm going to have to ask you about this, because I want to send a copy to George Clooney, and I don't know how.
Okay, I can help you.
But anyway, so the benefit to having dense networks is that you can coordinate action very quickly because there is this reservoir of trust that everybody has with each other. So if what you want is quick execution, the kind of social capital that George Clooney has, the small town social capital, is what you want. Now, Elon Musk's social capital is what I call big city social capital, which is, you know, comes from the fact that in a big city, you have a lot, typically more diversity in the types of people that you might come across. And what that diversity allows you to do is essentially get access to a lot more different types of information, which then you get to choose how you're going to leverage that information vis-a-vis other people in the network. So it gives you this power of leveraging information against other people, if that's how you want to use it. But it also gives you the opportunity to innovate by recombining information from different parts and creating new things that wouldn't have happened if you weren't in the very lovely position of having access to both types of information and being able to combine them in this unique way. So when we think about Elon Musk as an entrepreneur and all of the innovations that he's interested in, having that very diverse, big city type of social capital is actually very helpful for him.
Can you have both?
Yes, you can. Okay.
It's going to be hard.
Well, yes and no.
Okay, I want to hear this.
And this is, if I ever wrote like another book about networking, this is where I would like put an emphasis. So many people are hung up on their immediate network, mm-hmm. which is like who they know directly. But what they don't realize is that the diversity of the network of their first ties of the people they know is also part of their network. It also builds on your social capital. So you can have a close set of friends, but if each of those friends is friends with a, or is connected to a different set of groups, then you basically have the best of both worlds.
That's our author's club.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
I don't know if I've talked about this on the podcast. Do you want to talk about the team?
I want to talk about team. Wait,
I can't pronounce it. That's why I said talk about the team.
Oh, thanks, Kelly.
We have an unpronounceable team. First of all, we should bring this up at the next meeting. So I've been there since the close to the beginning, because Zoe Chance, mm-hmm. who started it, had been on the podcast. We also speak at a lot of the same events, so we've become pals over time. And she started this group of, it's mostly academics, but there are other people that get allowed in, like me, and occasionally my wife, Anne. Well, my wife Anne is an academic. Anyway, so we meet once a month when we can, and it's all people who are either writing books or have written books, giving advice and help to each other. But like, you and I didn't know each other,
but
because of this network, that's why we're talking here today.
Yeah, exactly. It's like your Second City network too, right? Like, yeah. You know, it works in a very similar way. So, yeah. So, presumably, Kelly, I believe what happened was that, well, first of all, you offered in the group very kindly mm-hmm. to have some of us on if the fit was good. But the group, in a way, serves as a screening mechanism. Because presumably we wouldn't let just anyone into the group, right? So then that actually makes it so that we have that kind of small town kind of trust in the group. But it's also true that, at least among the non-academics, mm-hmm. the network connections are very different. Mm-hmm. But what it means is that anybody who is in that group can then get access to those other connections through those direct relationships that they have in the group.
And there's people in that group, like the minute Dolly shows up, right? Uh-huh. Dolly Chug, you're like, all right, this is like everyone's favorite human. And you're like, okay. So, she, you know, her credit, and she's putting her credibility on the line in terms of this, just like, you know, and there's a few, Allison Wood Brooks is also, and she's a friend of mine too from way back. So it's I actually hadn't thought about that, but that is exactly what that group is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. You were teaching a session on networking at a different university, not Carnegie Mellon. And you went to the dining hall for breakfast and you tell this story in the book.
I know.
I love it. Can you tell it?
It is also one of my favorite stories. So, yeah. So as Kelly alluded to when you read my bio, a lot of the executive education programs that are run are actually oriented toward Black and Latino professionals. And this particular program was oriented toward Black professionals. And so in the dining hall, there were multiple exec ed programs going on. One was actually, turns out, an Asian professionals exec ed program, and then the other one was this Black leaders program that I was speaking with.
Yeah, because you do not look like a Black person. for those not on YouTube and just listening,
right? The present Chow differently. Should really
it should. You never know.
So I go into the dining hall the morning that I'm supposed to teach. I haven't met any of the participants yet, and I'm stuck with this like dilemma. Because I'm the first person to arrive. It's on the West Coast. I'm on East Coast time. So, of course, I woke up at like the crack of dawn and was just kind of waiting for the dining hall to open. And I have to make a decision like, oh, like, where do I sit? And obviously, I sit with the Black leaders at one of the tables labeled for Black leaders because that's the program that I'm teaching in. But it's just hilarious to me because as participants then start coming in, the participants in this Asian leadership program are looking at me because they clearly are like, are you sitting at the wrong table? And then you start seeing the Black leaders coming in And they're looking at me because they're thinking, aren't you sitting at the wrong table? And so I'm just very amused watching and wondering, like, what is going to happen? Like, is anyone going to sit with me? Like, is someone going to tell me that I'm at the wrong table? Like, what, how, who is going to take the first step here? And so this Black woman came. I saw her. She was like choosing whether or not she wanted to sit at my table or a different empty table, right? So that was the dilemma. And it was very clear. She was like, well, if I sit at the other table, it's meaningful because it means that I have actively chosen not to sit at the table with the Asian lady who may or may not be in the right place.
And so funny. It's so funny.
It was great. And so thankfully, I think for everyone involved, she decided to be the bigger person. And she was like, you know what? Like, let's see if I can help this poor woman out.
How quickly did you get to, this is why I belong at this table?
Very quickly. She was just like, hello, can I sit with you? And I was like, yes, absolutely. I'm Rosalind Chow. I'm going to be working with your group today. And in the Black Leaders Program, and she was like, oh my gosh, I'm so looking forward to your session. But she obviously hadn't internalized, like, she had seen on the schedule, right, that, like, they'd be working with someone called Rosalind Chow. But the internalization of, like, oh, maybe a Rosalind Chow is going to be Asian.
Well, that's system one, system two, like, happening. So I don't know if you know this, but we created a program at the University of Chicago with Nick Epley and Eilat Fischbach and a bunch of folks called the Second Science Project. It looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And we created orientation programs that are still going on there. And one of the exercises that we took that we applied from improv and we brought over with us, it's maybe one of the first things that we do in this orientation program, which is we circle all the freshmen up and we basically say, we're going to read out some attributes. And if one of them applies to you, move to another place in the circle. It's called I am somebody who. So it's like, I'm somebody who wears jeans. I'm somebody who has blonde hair. I'm somebody who owns a gun. I'm someone who identifies as Christian. I'm somebody, and it gets increasingly. And the thing that people realize after you've gone through this for a while is like, I never would have thought the vegan had a gun. And that's the point, right? What we're trying to say to them is you're going to make a bunch of assumptions for all kinds of very logical reasons.
Right.
And you're going to be wrong.
Right.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
So this idea that comes up in your book that came up in the work there was the value of being seen for all the different parts that you are and how incredibly meaningful that is.
Yeah. Well, and this becomes particularly important when we start talking about networking, where so a big part of the book that I like to emphasize is that, you know, the book is about sponsorship, but it really is about rethinking how we think about how we orient towards social relationships. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, networking is this kind of weird, icky topic. My own assessment of that is because the way that most of us think about networking now is that we essentially have like turned ourselves into commodities that we're trying to sell to other people because we're trying to convince other people that we're worth their time and that we're, you know, that we would be a valuable connection for them to have. And so this relates to what you're speaking about, Kelly, because people also use a lot of these physical cues as an indicator of how much value you have as a network partner, right? As a network contact. So there's often this assumption that women's networks are not as like high quality or as powerful as men's. Same for racial minorities. And that's just generally not true. And so one of the things that I feel like is really important for people to think about is like when it's so unfortunate to go to these sorts of networking events and have people make this kind of millisecond assessment of whether or not you're worth their time based on these cues that are not good indicators, right, of your actual value. And so you're absolutely right. It's this idea that so many of us are trying to save time. So we're relying on these stereotypes as a way to kind of cut down on the amount of cognitive effort we have to go through. But when we do that, it really cheapens our connections. And so approaching connections with, you know, without those sorts of assumptions in mind are kind of important for this.
That's very generously put. It is hard living in the world as it is right now, especially with the knowledge that you have. And, you know, I mean, this is this, and it's this thing. I was talking to my boss the other day. So this is like 4 or 5 weeks ago. He's like, look, maybe it's 3 weeks ago. It was like, look, we all know it's bad. We got to come to work. We got to do our bit. I'm like, okay, I get it. But the other day he's like, I don't know, man, it's so bad. And I think for me, it's not just the lack of knowledge or the de-emphasis or we've paid too much. It's the cruelty. It's the unseeing that I am now actually choosing to unsee you or say you don't belong because you aren't, quite frankly, a straight white male.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are you doing to keep yourself sane these days?
Oh, gosh. I mean, okay.
Help our audience. Is there anything you're doing? Putting a blanket over your head?
Well,
what are you doing?
So, yes, and?
Yes.
I keep in mind that I have to role model what I want my children to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, oftentimes there are times when I would love to just say, like, screw all those people. I mean, But I know that that's not setting up my kids, their generation, and society for success. So then I have to take a step back and think about how I would like my children to be treated by others, and then I try to be that person.
Yeah.
But yes, I do think that if I did not have children, I would have a really hard time.
Yeah, I get you. I mean, I just had this experience, which was actually a good one. We got invited to present at the 44th annual Hostage Negotiation Conference in Baltimore. So this is mostly FBI and departments that deal with hostage negotiations, scenarios, situations. And we've been doing work in this area with the FBI and work with the University of Chicago Crime Lab and others. We're new to it. And we were kind of warned by our sponsor, that, you know, this audience might be in a different place than when we'd been doing our other sessions, which were before this current administration came in. It went great. And we had so many conversations before and after with people who I 100% know vote differently than me, think differently than me. But because we had shared so much vulnerable information about ourselves, losses, harms, those sort of things, and related it back, there was just, it did that, that, that wasn't an important part of this 3-day thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me a kind of hope that is kind of missing if I'm just on social media.
Yeah. I mean, that whole part about going deeper and being able to see other people, in terms of their values and what's important to them, there's the values that you state you have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which sometimes are perhaps not stated in a way that makes it feel very warm and fuzzy for others. But then I would guess that most of us enact our values in ways that are universal.
Yeah, holding
right?
the door.
In the sense that we care deeply about our family. We care deeply about contributing to the communities that we're a part of. it's not like we're going out saying that we just want to take advantage of other people or that we want like a free handout or anything like that, right? Like, I don't know anybody who goes around saying that, right? And so when we talk about the ways in which we actually enact our values, I think that that's an opportunity to connect. And it sounds like in your example, right, all of that opening up about personal vulnerabilities, the things that make us sad are also things that tell us about the things we value.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's all information that we can use to infer like your values are very similar to mine. And that's, you know, that's the path to building trust is knowing that you have shared values.
Well, and honestly, it was after my conversation with Kurt Gray and reading his book
that
I decided very consciously. And I talk about, you know, our daughter who passed away from cancer and when she was 17. And there's so many lessons that we learned from there because we created improvisation programs around caregiving. So I wasn't looking, I didn't want anything from it, but I wanted also to, you know, connect with people in the audience through what Kurt sort of says. It's like, you share your harms, you know, and as long as you're doing that, it's like, I'm not trying to, I can't get anything from you. I'm not here to sell you anything. I am here because I really believe in improvisation as a tool by which we can practice being human in a way that that books aren't going to give you, just books alone. So, yeah. The other thing, and I'm going to ask for your yes and story in a moment, but the other thing that you talk about and certainly is so important to our work is good listening.
Yes.
What makes a good listener?
Oh, I ask my students this all the time. Okay. So, a person who is a good listener is someone who's paying attention. empathic and importantly non-judgmental. And so when I talk to my students about this, they talk about how they realize that they are good listeners to the extent that what they care about is just understanding the content, but they aren't good listeners in the sense of creating a connection. And those are different things. So, I talk about an exercise that we go through. There's a lot of nonverbals involved, in terms of how you convey that you're really listening to the other person. But the key is that there's this virtuous cycle to good listening where if you're a really good listener, well, first, if you ask good questions and you're a really good listener, people end up telling you more about themselves than maybe they would have intended. And that non-judgmental piece is really key, where you don't necessarily tell them, you're not indicating to them what you want to hear, simply that you are paying attention. When they start sharing deeper information with you, that actually makes the conversation more interesting, which then actually makes you listen even more, right? And be an even better listener. And it just becomes this cycle where you get better and better information about the other person. And a lot of that information is relevant to these experiences that we've had, right? That, as we just talked about, are manifestations of what we value.
I imagine when you took improv, that's probably one of the first things you recognize. You're like, wow, everyone's really listening to each other because they have to. There's no script.
Well, I was in level one.
Okay, all right. Fair point. We're still trying to get you just not to be in judgment of yourself.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, no, you're not trying to be funny.
Yeah, stop with it. Yeah, there's always that dude in the class too, right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. You got one for us?
Yes. So this is actually how I got started with the path of writing the book is someone in an exec ed reached out to me. So you read the story in the book. Someone in exec ed reached out to me and was like, would you be interested in putting together a curriculum and be the faculty lead for this new program that we are potentially spinning up. It's going to be for Black leaders. You would lead it. It's going to have the sponsorship component. And I was like, let me hold up. Hold up here. Let me tell you all the ways in which this seems like a terrible idea. I have only taught in exec ed once. It went terribly. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been asked back to exec ed like ever since. So it'd been like 5 years since I had done exec ed, which then means that I'd never directed any sort of exec ed program. And also, by the way, I'm not Black. So I was very close to saying no. Thankfully, my colleague, Lori Weingart, basically was kind of like, what do you have to lose? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the worst that can happen? You're trying to tackle this problem that so many people have tried to tackle, and it hasn't ever worked out very well. You know, so the worst that can happen is like your program is going to be like as good as what has come before. Or there's also this possibility that it will be much better than what has come before. And so I found that really like meaningful. So I said yes. And then on top of that, I was like, well, given that I have nothing to lose, then I'm going to ask for everything that I want. And what I mean by that is not like that I asked for a lot of money, because that's not what I mean. What I meant was like, I wanted to create a program that was unapologetically about the Black experience. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of programming up to that point was just kind of like, let's bring a bunch of Black professionals together. We'll give them the standard exec ed training, right? But at least they're doing it together as, you know, Black professionals. And I really didn't want that. I mm-hmm. wanted them to come in and to be very plain and just say, like, your challenges are special and you have challenges. Like, let us be very clear. You have challenges that are different. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I would say that probably was a little bit of a risk in retrospect. Now I recognize it as like one of the best things about the program is it's just so affirming for Black and Latino participants to have somebody come in and say out loud what they have been experiencing. I guess probably since George Floyd happened, that's probably less new, but this program started before George Floyd, and people were just, you could see they were shocked that they were having this experience, like in a good way, in the sense that they had never had like a really safe space to talk about their experiences. And that has just like, it's one of the most meaningful experiences I've had in my life of being able to create an environment like that for others.
Such a gift. The book is called The Doors You Can Open, A New Way to Network, Build Trust, and Use Your Influence to Create a More Inclusive Workplace. Rosalind Chao, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survives the 10 million feet. Adulthood, no one survives.